Hello and welcome to the Clinical Oncology Podcast. My name is Lei Wang and I'm excited to be co-hosting this episode with Saif Ahmed. In this episode, we've got a great interview with Professor Chris Booth, who is the senior author of our January Editor's Choice article. Chris is a GI medical oncologist at Queen's University, Ontario. He's a prolific researcher and passionate advocate for access and value in cancer care. Clinicians always need to be conscious of using our resources in the most cost-effective way, and those cost-effective treatments are not necessarily the ones that get the most attention. The article is entitled Industry Funding of Oncology Randomized Controlled Trials: Implications for Design, Results and Interpretation. I'd strongly recommend you take a look. It's a fascinating read. The authors analysed all Phase 3 randomised controlled trials of cancer therapy published between 2014 and 2017, altogether 694. Most of them were industry-sponsored, 71%. They observed that industry-sponsored trials were more likely to be in breast or lung cancer, disproportionate to the public health burden, and in the palliative setting. Industry-sponsored trials were overwhelmingly 97% looking at systemic therapies, as opposed to radiotherapy or surgery. Furthermore, they were more likely to be published in higher impact journals and thus influence clinical practice. The paper offers some interesting theories about these observations and points out that profitability should not be the main determinant of research topic. We hope you'll enjoy this interview. Okay, Chris, lovely to have you on the podcast and thanks for joining us. We really enjoyed the paper that you had out in our January edition of Clinical Oncology, and it was chosen as our editor's choice. So you and your co-authors found some quite interesting observations, interesting differences between industry funded trials, phase three RCTs versus non-industry funded. Can I ask, what is the main message that you and your co-authors wanted to convey with this article?
Great question. And thanks, Lei and Saif, for inviting me to join you today. I think the bottom line message would be that the oncology clinical trial ecosystem now is heavily, heavily funded and therefore heavily influenced by the pharmaceutical industry. So I think that's the key point. The next point would be that, not surprisingly, clinical trials led by industry are very different from clinical trials that are not led by industry. And then I guess the really, 30,000 foot big picture question here is, what is the appropriate allocation of who funds the research agenda? And have we tipped the pendulum too far to one side? And I have feelings about that, I'm sure we'll get into during the discussion, but there's a real need for other forms of research to answer questions that may or may not be of interest to the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, and what sort of other questions? Can you give some examples?
Yeah, so I think, as we found in our paper, most clinical trials now are testing new cancer medicines. And even though I'm a medical oncologist and I'd be quite pleased to see new evidence coming out for medicines, as medical oncologists, we have to have some humility and recognize that equally, if not more important, is the delivery of radiotherapy and surgery. In fact, if you look at curative intent treatment, that's obviously the most important modalities are radiation and surgery. And so I think that there's need for balance so that we can advance and do clinical trials in more than just drugs. We need to be able to test new approaches in both surgery and radiotherapy. But then there's also many questions, even in the drug space, that may not be of interest to the pharmaceutical industry. How can we deliver care that is less intense, closer to home, fewer side effects? How can we de-escalate care? I mean, the idea of collaborative in colorectal cancer is a brilliant example, and a major international series of clinical trials that radically improve the delivery of care for patients by de-escalating treatment. So that's just within the kind of the formal context of cancer therapies as we think of in the cancer center. But then there's so many other questions that patients want to learn about that, again, will not be funded by the pharmaceutical industry. Studies of diet, exercise, lifestyle, mindfulness, meditation, clinical trials to improve our communication skills as clinicians. How should we break bad news? When should we do it? What information do patients want about their prognosis and how do they want to receive that information? There's really unlimited number of questions that need to be addressed to improve the care we deliver. And so we need to have, I think, a better balance in the research funding portfolio to ensure that we can address those questions as well. And I guess I should just say at the outset that I'm not suggesting that we have no clinical trials funded by industry. Clearly, we need industry partners to advance the agenda and identify new and promising therapeutics for our patients. Many of the treatments that we use every day that have huge benefits for our patients come from clinical trials that were led and funded by industry. So I'm not suggesting we get rid of those, but just I think we need to have some discussions with our own within our own community about how the current ecosystem is imbalanced.
Thank you for that. That's a really clear message. So in your view, then, what can help to rebalance the system?
Yeah, so I think from a pragmatic point of view, I guess there's a few levels. So, I mean, we found that there's differences in trials led by industry. So I think you can think of, if we conceptualize this at the level of the clinician. So as consumers of the literature, I think, you know, we should always be wary of potential forms of bias and confounding in studies that we read about. And sponsorship bias is one such entity that we should think about. So there's some issues about how the trial is designed, how the results are interpreted and presented. So there's issues there at the level of consuming medical literature. I think there's also an advocacy role that we can play as oncologists and as trialists, which is to advocate for alternative funding streams. And I think that one of the reasons that our current environment is largely driven by funding from industry is that I think government grants have become increasingly difficult to get. The budgets for research, I mean, obviously, I don't need to tell you in the UK, there've been major, major problems recently with government research budgets. And I think that if we don't have new sources of funding from either government or from philanthropic groups, we're still going to be left in a context where most of the funding will be coming from the pharmaceutical industry.
I suppose an alternative would be, for example, regulating industry-funded trials a bit more. So it's probably a little bit controversial, but so, for example, what do you think about regulating industry-funded trials, such as, for example, saying that they can't use medical writers and they can't have access to the data, stuff like that, until it's published?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's some kind of more extreme thought experiments floating out there. One that I've thought about and other people have is, you know, maybe industry just gives the money to an arm's-length entity that then runs the trial. And I mean, that's appealing in some ways because then the methods, the interpretation, the analysis is done by an arm's length. We would probably be less prone to some of the trouble we have with imbalance in control arms and endpoints. I mean, I think it's also important to take a step back and look at, you know, the methods of most industry-funded trials are actually very strong. In fact, there's some literature to suggest their methodology is even more robust than other trials. The problem when it gets to things that are more difficult to measure, typically follow-up, utilization of imaging, crossover, secondary therapies, appropriateness of a control arm. So I think at the most extreme level, you could ask yourself, you know, is there a role for an arm's length entity to run the trials on behalf of industry? So that's, you know, a bit of a more extreme thought experiment. There's probably some other simple things that can be done, though. First is, you know, teaching trainees to critically appraise the literature. The other is, I think that editors of journals need to be very careful in how results are spun and presented in abstract. There's a lot of spin. This comes from every author, whether they're funded by industry or not. It's human nature. If we've worked for years on something, even if it didn't look like it worked, we're going to want to find something beneficial for all the fruits of our labor over many, many years. But I think that's the job of reviewers and especially editors, especially when it comes to abstracts. So I think that journals can play a role in helping to hold the authors of any clinical trial, regardless of who funds it, accountable. And I think medical writers are something that needs to be completely removed. You know, we've talked about this in other contexts. We've done some writing about this, but the fact that 2/3 of clinical trials of new drug therapies are now being co-authored with a paid professional medical writer is really entirely contrary to tenets of academic medicine and academic scholarship in general that we hold very dearly. So I think that should be a practice that should be, quite frankly, eliminated, or at least I think investigators who put their names on paper should be embarrassed if it's being written by a paid medical writer. So there's probably something we just need to talk about.
Can I ask, if you had unlimited funding and resources to conduct a trial, what would you do it on?
That's a really good question. I've never been asked that before. So what I wouldn't do is more of what's already being done, which is adding more and more treatment, more and more intensity, more and more toxicity, more and more expense. Some of those trials are useful and necessary, but lots of people are doing that. I think I would invest in trials that are not really being answered right now. I think there's a lot of over-treatment and over-imaging. I think we could do clinical trials to look at, can we safely de-escalate the intensity of care and follow-up to help preserve quality of life, reduce side effects, reduce time toxicity for our patients. So I think I'd be interested in a bundle of research that looks at that. I think I would also invest in clinical trials to better understand communication tools and strategies for how we can better convey prognostic information, and also how we can convey information about the magnitude of benefit, and to really learn from patients what it is they're looking for in new cancer therapies, as opposed to what we as oncologists think our patients are looking for. And then finally, I'm the co-PI on an international RCT of exercise. This is being done by the Canadian Cancer Trials Group, and it's been going for about a decade now. We're nearing the completion. It's actually enrolling at patients from the UK as well. And so I think there's a lot that patients would like to learn about the role of lifestyle. And I think we need to test those interventions as rigorously as we do other interventions in oncology. And so I think my unlimited funds, I'd probably have a budget as well for interventions of lifestyle.
Thank you. Those are all really, really important areas to be focusing on. And looking at this sort of discipline as a whole that you've been practicing and clearly excelling in, what led you in your career to sort of take this role, and where do you see it going in future?
So I think the work that I do in the value space came from my earliest days as an oncology trainee, when I effectively, walked into the cancer center as a layperson. I didn't really know anything about cancer therapeutics, and I saw amazing examples of clinical care, great compassion, communication skills. I saw treatments and interventions that made a tremendous difference in the quality of life and outcomes of our patients. But I must admit, I was surprised at how much of our care had very, very either poor evidence to support its use, or robust evidence but showing very, very small benefits. I was shocked, actually. And I think maybe we just kind of get used to that as you get deeper into oncology. I've never really lost that maybe inherent skepticism about some of the things that we take for granted and we do every day. And so it was that. And I also had the privilege of being mentored by Ian Tannock at Princess Margaret Hospital, who has, had a career of asking these important questions. And so I got very interested in this from the early days, and the first kind of oncology project I did with Dr. Tannock was, the first chapter in what we call the evolution of the RCT in oncology, which has been a series of papers we do every few years, where we use the same methods to look back in the previous decade at systemic therapy trials in breast, lung, and colorectal, and we track these changes. We've been doing now tracking it going back to the mid-1970s, and so I've had quite a bit of interest in where we're going with trials, the concept of endpoint. And I think this is something that both I find interesting, but I think it's actually really important. We put our patients through an awful lot, and I think it's important that we always retain perspective about what it is we're trying to achieve, and is what we're asking the patient to do in their best interest and going to help them. And ultimately, it's not really up to us to make that decision, but I think we can do a better job at least conveying the magnitude of benefit and information to patients so that they can make decisions that are most in keeping with their own values and preferences.
Thanks, Chris. You mentioned that you're PI on a project that's coming up, but can I ask you to just talk about maybe specifically one thing that's really exciting that you're working on at the moment?
Let's see, what are we doing in clinical trials? Here's something. So we've got a body of work that's actually coming out of some of, the paper that we're discussing today in clinical oncology, where we've done an overview of clinical trials and we found differences with industry studies compared to non-industry studies. So out of that database of clinical trials, we're exploring concepts of what we call research parachutism. And so this is the concept in global health where investigators, typically from high-income countries, undertake research in lower resource settings, and it's a parachute phenomenon. They parachute in and parachute out, and it's not a very flattering chapter in the history of global health. And I think there's greater awareness of some of these problems. But in the spirit of kind of, promoting bidirectional research and learning from other systems and other countries, we're using this database to explore a few issues of research parachutism. So one of them is looking at authorship, and is authorship of clinical trials Is it, does it reflect where the study was being conducted and who did the work, who enrolled the patients? So that's one piece of work we have ongoing. Another is when trials which are led by high-income countries enroll patients in either low, middle, or upper middle-income countries, which countries are those? And is it countries for which there already is an established research relationship? So we're kind of looking at where do high-income countries go? And is there some patterns or some rationale for why they might go to those countries? And then the third kind of research parachute project, I should mention these are both being led by my research fellows. So Adam Fanditis is leading the first one. And the latter two is being led by Fidel Rubagumya, who's from Rwanda, but spending a year and a half with us here at Queen's. So the third parachute project, which Fidel is leading, is asking the question for new cancer therapeutics, which were identified in clinical trials that enroll patients in low, middle, and upper middle income countries. If you look after the drug was approved and the trial was published, to what extent is that medicine actually available in the countries that enrolled patients for these trials? And we have some pretty strong a priori hypotheses about what we're going to find. But again, it's looking to see whether the countries and the health systems that generated the knowledge to show that these treatments work, whether those health systems have any longer term benefit and whether they actually have access to these medicines. So those are some things we've got cooking right now.
I guess it's really sad if someone benefits from a drug in a trial and then when the trial is over, it's withdrawn.
Yeah, so I think there's generally pretty strong kind of protections in most clinical trial protocols to avoid that scenario, although there may be examples of that. So it's looking beyond the trial patients. And so if the trial was completed a couple of years ago, it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, every high-income country starts using the drug, are patients in the lower resource settings, are they even able to get it? So if a country is enrolling patients and contributing to that, is there any chance that down the road, oncologists and patients in those countries will have access to these medicines?
Yeah, really good point.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I mean, one thing I'll just end on, and I went to a really good science communication talk, but we have a newspaper here called The Guardian, which is quite a good newspaper.
Yeah.
And their lead journalist was just talking about when things make the press, just like, why does it get so exaggerated? And it resonated with me because basically there's like a terrible positive feedback loop of the researcher when they're selling their research to their, you know, their professor or PI writing the article, you kind of inflate it a little bit. Then when it comes to the editors on the other side of like once you submit it, the editors on the other side are trying to inflate it a little bit to increase the impact so more people read it. And then that article, then when it gets, you try and get a press release on it, you inflate it a little bit more to try and get a journalist interested in it. But even that journalist, he has to inflate it a little bit more to get his main editor to include it in the newspaper. So you've got this incremental gain in that is pretty
You're
dangerous.
Absolutely right. Yeah. And that ends up, that's why the front page of The Guardian and the, you know, newspapers in Canada, they overstate almost everything, right? You know, it should have been the IDEA Collaborative in colorectal cancer should have been front page news, but it's not, right? It's never going to be front page news, de-escalation care. I mean, it's highly unlikely to be. And I initially, when I thought about this is another project I have actually ongoing with my colleagues at King's College London, as we're doing, and Fidel is leading it. We're doing a systematic review to understand the extent to which media overhype new cancer therapies. And other groups have worked on this, and so we're going to try to pool together the literature in this space. And in discussions, it's come out that it's actually not just the journalists and the reporters that are responsible here. It's actually the institutions and the PIs who are putting out the press releases. And, you know, we can't expect journalists to be experts in critical appraisal. I mean, maybe a dedicated health reporter should probably have some skills in that area. But I think that we as a field need to take ownership. And you see some of the stuff coming out of, you know, the ASCO press releases or ESTRO or whatever, and they're completely over the top. And this is the stuff that we can control, right? We have ownership of that. So we as a collective kind of group of oncologists, so I think we need to be a little bit more, show some humility when it comes to writing up our results and recognize that, of course, it's human nature to want to find something beneficial in things that we do. But we have to be careful it doesn't cross a line and overstate benefit and ultimately, you know, mislead patients.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Chris. I just really wanted to thank you for your time and both an excellent article, but then discussing around it so eloquently. So thank you very much for your time.
That's great. Yeah. Thanks, guys. Thanks for including me.
Bye.